That's one of my all-time favorites. No questions asked about that. Stanley Turrentine on tenor sax with River's Invitation. It's from his 1965 album, Joyride, featuring Herbie Hancock on piano, Kenny Burrell on guitar, Bob Cranshaw on bass, and Grady Tate on drums. And a phenomenal orchestra, including names like Clark Terry and Ernie Royal and Snooky Young on trumpet, Henry Coker, J.J. Johnson, and Jimmy Cleveland on trombone, Phil Woods on alto sax and clarinet, Jerry Dodgen on alto sax, flute, and piccolo and clarinet, Danny Bank on baritone sax and clarinet, and Robert Ashton on tenor sax, and Albert Johnson on tenor sax as well, and, of course, Oliver Nelson, as the conductor and arranger. We played some of his music earlier this week. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, July the 2nd, 2015. And today, a case against the president. It's a very riveting program, and I'm looking forward to it. In a June 29th article in the political journal Counterpunch, Thomas Ruffin, an activist and attorney in private practice in Washington, D.C., just took no prisoners. He made the case that President Barack Obama is, quote, a race traitor, unquote. The provocative article is the focal point of our discussion today, and I welcome you, Thomas Ruffin, to Lead Stories. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Eutrice.
Well, as I was reading, I could swear that I was seeing fumes just evaporating from the screen. It was really hot. First of all, why would you say that the president is a race traitor? I mean, I want you to put into context, if you will, this your definition of race. What is race in the context of your article, and why is the president, in your view, a race traitor?
Well, the precise words I used was, President Obama is a traitor to the black race. And then in the article, I think I said twice that he's a traitor to our race. So you're speaking quite accurately on what I said. What I meant by that, when I refer to race, I'm actually talking about the political content of the notion that black people make up a race of people. So I'm drawing from what apparently was an 18th century, rather racist 18th century categorization of different peoples of colors throughout the world, wherein white, pale-skinned Europeans were regarded as Caucasian or white. Brown-skinned people in Africa and of African descent were regarded as Negroid, and that's politically been changed over the centuries to black. And in this country, we refer to it oftentimes as African-American. People in East Asia, whether they were pale, dark-skinned, light-skinned, they were referred to as yellow. And indigenous people in this country who were brown like you and me were referred to as red. So the notion of white people, black people, red people, and yellow people as a general categorization of race, racial groups, or racial stocks is what I refer to, except in the context that since there is no sound scientific delineation of one group of people according to the skin, the color of their skin, as opposed to another, such that you can distinctly say with all the admixture over the generations that there's really a race, and to a degree that, you know, it, in terms of science, might not make any sense. What I'm really talking about is the political content and meaning that that has in American society and in almost all of the world. And that is, to a degree, we build political allegiance with each other or have the potential for doing so based on the color of our skin. And in this country, where black people, as I've generally referred to them earlier, are the descendants of people, largely the descendants of people who were kidnapped in Africa, brought here as prisoners of war, and enslaved and forced to breed their children into slavery. And on even past the outlaw of slavery into the present day, brown-skinned people, whom we refer to as black, who came out of that experience, I'm referring to as black. And although Barack Obama's father was Kenyan, and he and his line of Africans weren't actually brought here as captives of war and enslaved, such that Barack Obama descended from his father or his ancestry in that way. I'm still taking note that peoples in Africa and even in Kenya during the colonial period from the 19th century on through the early part of the 20th century endured such harsh genocidal conditions that oftentimes they were actually enslaved in their homeland or so closely rendered to such a situation in a kind of colonialized serfdom that more or less I regard them as part of the black race that came out of that Eurocentric imperial imposition on African peoples, and also Arab imposition on African peoples to the degree that we can delineate ourselves on the basis of color as black, as opposed to European people who, during that epoch, had an imperial domination over us, particularly in the slave trade, and then in some parts of Africa, that they would be regarded as white in contrast. So that's what I mean. Insofar as Barack Obama would be politically regarded as black, he betrays our need for unity and social uplift that we put together. And particularly since we oftentimes, so many of us, the overwhelming majority of us who voted during the 2008 election and 2012 election, voted him into office with the hope that he would be the first black president and that he would do a fine job at that. But what I mean by saying he's a traitor to the race is that insofar as he got elected, he served a great many important interest groups, but he has barely at all served black people. So in that regard, just as a summary, he's mightily served the Zionist state of Israel ever since he was elected, even before his election. He mightily served the billionaires on Wall Street, encouraging the Federal Reserve to give trillions of dollars to Wall Street and to loan trillion dollars of Wall Street, and also authorizing along with George Bush for the Treasury Department to give trillions of dollars at Wall Street and similar businesses for their uplift during the depression that hit at the end of 2007 and became manifest in 2008 and carried on up until 2010, in fact. He bailed them out. He bailed the multinational automobile manufacturers in Detroit out. That's Chrysler, General Ford, and General Motors and Ford. He bailed out the auto parts manufacturers and so on and on. But when it came to black people, the people who most desperately need his help, and similarly with indigenous black people, the so-called Indians, I basically find him to have largely neglected our concerns. And that's after he promised not to have lobbyists in his administration. And he has many former lobbyists in his administration, and he serves the interests of those people, those entities which many of his cabinet members and many others in his administration used to serve. So that's generally what I mean. He's ignored our interests and done so to the advantage of people and entities that have taken full advantage of his powers and influence as the president of the United States.
Well, here's a fair question.
Mm-hmm.
First, I thank you for defining this the context of race. I want to ask the question, what would be the rationale for anybody connected with reality today to actually have had so much faith? I mean, it's I understand that we did. People did have faith. A wide swath of people, including, by the way, progressives, people who are also identified with a progressive agenda.
You mean,
given what we know politics is all about, and we saw that there was perhaps no lever to force, no cudgel. This is not about, well, you know, we elected him and there's this euphoric reaction, he's going to do the right thing. There was an absence of a cudgel, an absence of a lever to compel him to toe the line. In your view, was that also a major factor here, or was it all about Obama on his own deciding to meet the needs of the oligarchy, if you will, and ignore the constituencies that put him in office not once but twice? Where did the people fail, and where did the people participate in this traitorous, these traitorous acts that you've just defined?
Okay, that's a very good question. And in many different ways and with many different words, people ask, I think, more or less the same question of me and others who make observations along the line that I made. First of all, when you say what rationale for the faith that I take it you and others like me saw in people, let's say black people who voted mightily for Obama, I mean, in very, very high percentage, far, far higher than just simply 90%. I think it was more than 96% of the voting black public in the U.S. voted for President Obama. So, and they did so with the expectation that he would be an extraordinary president and that he would do right by black people and others in our situation. Well, when you say that, you ask a good question, as I said earlier, and I have to answer that in light of what President Obama stated in his campaign from 2006 until he was elected in 2008, and then in light of his conduct during his first term in office before he was reelected, I don't find a lot of reason for, say, black people, poor people, indigenous peoples, or others to have thought that he would serve our interests as poor and working class and as lower middle class people. Now, if we were wealthy, exceedingly powerful, like, say, Robert Johnson or Oprah Winfrey, to name a few people in entertainment or invested in entertainment, black people of that nature who were capitalists, as well as just black people and of African descent. No, I think we can distinguish them. But for the rest of us, I think there are two-part answer to your question. First of all, I don't think there was a basis a sound or reasonable basis for us to have faith that he would do anything for us. He didn't do much of anything for us in the U.S. Senate. He certainly pushed for a settlement for the black farmers, a favorable settlement for the black farmers, but there's more to it than him simply pushing for that. And then he did very little for us, as I understand, when he served in the Illinois Senate. Matter of fact, when he was in the Illinois Senate, he represented parts of the south side of Chicago, and part of the region that he represented included neighborhoods where many black men had been arrested by Chicago police and tortured by detectives working under the leadership of a man named John Berg, a detective John Berg. And these people, these black men, and I mean scores of black men, I mean scores of black men, were tortured for about two and a half decades, from the late 1970s until late into the 1990s. And they were tortured, and in that torture, oftentimes forced to confess to murders that they didn't commit. And as a result, some of these black men were sentenced to life for murders they didn't commit. Some were sentenced to death. One man, I believe, came within 4 days of being executed in Illinois. And during the course of that, as I understand, Barack Obama did very little as an Illinois state senator to address that issue. He did do one thing that was noteworthy, and that was to require that any interrogation, police interrogation of a person suspected of murder in Illinois must be videotaped so as to protect against the torture. But you didn't hear anything about that on his part when District Attorney Daley ran for mayor and became mayor. You didn't hear anything about that when the revelations of torture by the U.S. military and the CIA in Afghanistan and Iraq came to the fore, and when we heard about the allegations of torture at Guantanamo Bay. In other words, he has been closely linked to or thoroughly informed about torture either by local police state operatives or by military and spy operatives of the United States government, and he has done very little, if anything, to stop it. And in the case of the black men in Chicago who were the victims of that, he didn't even stand as an open champion of that. Rather, he's been known to talk about American exceptionalism and this being the greatest country in the world, always for good and justice, with a few occasional mishaps that will be righted by the good people of America. So to me, that's a misrepresentation and a hypocritical representation at that. And so insofar as he played down this torture incident on that occasion, that should have let us know that he might be more loyal to the American police state than the black people who may be the victims of policing in this country. And then I add on to this the other thing. When you say the voters or the people as a constituency, unlike the billionaires and their agents on Wall Street, unlike the American automotive industry, unlike the state of Israel, and unlike a host of others, like American banking industries and the like, who've lobbied President Obama effectively, black people in this country, indigenous people in this country, and others who've been oppressed or who are poor have not united so as to be clear about what is their political agenda before the federal government. And they have not determined the way in which that agenda, if ever clearly crystallized, would be presented to the president so as to understand that our vote is linked to addressing that agenda effectively. And moreover, we haven't, to the degree we've pressed the federal government or state and municipal governments in any way, we're not assiduous at it. We must be into that daily, always, without stop. I'll give you a perfect example. I've already alluded to some very good examples, but when you think about multinational and wealthy businesses in this country, as represented by the U.S. Chambers of Congress, U.S. Chambers of Commerce, and as represented by the Republican Party, and sometimes by the Tea Party, they consistently ask for lower taxes and deregulation. They've been asking for it since Jimmy Carter was in office, even before then. But under Obama, they've consistently said the taxes are too high, the regulation is too tough, and that the government, the federal government under President Obama, is in their way. And no matter what breaks he gave them, what opportunities he provided, or what subsidies he made available to them, they still complain without stop that they need lower taxes. And they know that there's not going to be any settlement with regard to federal tax, income tax liability being changed while Obama's the president and while the Republicans dominate the Congress. But they consistently press that, and they'll press that until, once again, they will get a tax cut, or until we close that down. That is, the rest of the nation close it down. They received tax cuts under Reagan. They received tax cuts under Clinton. And they received a very good, thorough tax cut under George W. Bush. And they're demanding more of the same from Obama and the current Congress. We don't do that with regard to our interests. And to the degree we don't do that, we don't get anything. So if you say that we have a responsibility as a people, you're right. But since Obama is at least putatively from our people, he should be willing and able to address those concerns as president of the United States. Keep in mind, he's the leader of the most powerful organization of people on the planet. He's the leader of the most powerful military on the planet. He's the leader of the wealthiest organization of people on the planet. The U.S. government, the United States government, will spend more than $4 trillion this year and will do so every year into the long-term future. There is no entity on the planet that spends like that. There is no police state on the planet as strong as the United States government. There's no military on the planet, not even Russia's, not even China's, and certainly not Islamic State that's as powerful as the U.S. military. Barack Obama, President Obama, is in charge of that organization. And he stepped out mightily for Israel. He stepped out mightily for the billionaires on Wall Street. He stepped out mightily for a number of issues and interests. But he's never vigorously, in earnest, stepped out for us.
So, in as much as you indict him on that count, does your indictment also extend to organizations that supposedly lobby for in the interest of African Americans and the poor, like the Urban League, the NAACP, the Black Church, the religious organizations, and others that we see paraded all the time as the so-called leaders of the African American community? These are people who are supposedly influencing Barack Obama's policies. Do you extend the indictment to them as well?
Well, my critique was of President Obama's administration. He's served 6.5 years as President of the United States and has done that after serving 4 years in the U.S. Senate. He's now a lame duck president, so I focused on him. I didn't write a treatise on all those black and white charitable, governmental, or individual entities that could have or should have served the interests of black folk. I think there could be and has often been a critique of many different entities along the lines that you alluded to. But I focused on President Obama, and let me be clear, I did so not because I know the man and I hate him, or I really don't know him. I really targeted his political work, the public policy stances that he stood for and that he's enforced, and his public advocacy as president of the United States. That's what I focused on. And I did so because I noticed, first of all, as I said earlier, he hasn't served the interests of black people and others who I regard as oppressed or desperately in need of the protection and advocacy of the federal government. But I did so also because I see in the black community something that kind of goes with your question at the outset and maybe links in with the second question. And that is that many in the black community and elsewhere in this society and even in the world look at President Obama a lot like we should have looked at Jackie Robinson, a great entertainer, the first recognized black athlete to play Major League Baseball in this country. And we kind of look at him like we review Kerry Washington. I can't say she's the first, but an extraordinarily talented, beautiful, gracious actress who's like bombing the daylights out of American television with her leading role in Scandal. It's not the first time a black woman or a black person has had a leading role in a highly rated program, but this show has been enormously popular, and at one point, if not still, it was the number one program on television. And we just look at them because they're entertainers, and we're just happy for them. You know, and I'm not talking about the aesthetic quality of the show Scandal, and I'm not talking about the political advocacy of Jackie Robinson after he retired from Major League Baseball. But what I'm talking about is they were entertainers, an athlete and an actress. They were entertainers. President Obama is the head of government. He has obligations to all of the people in the country, and he oftentimes boasted that the president has those obligations. And many who side with him bring to our attention that he's president of all the people, not just black folk. My complaint is that he's hardly ever been a president for black people, but he's been mightily the president on behalf of Israel, on behalf of the billionaires and their interests on Wall Street, on behalf of the banking industry, on behalf of multinational countries that wanted a trade agreement with South Korea, that wanted a trade agreement with Colombia, and now want a trade agreement with several nations in Southeast Asia. He is their champion, and they assiduously seek his service. We don't seek the service, and he has not ever been our champion. Quite the contrary, I really regard his occasional statements wherein he seems to be sympathetic about the condition of black people, such as after the death of Trayvon Martin, and then at the funeral for State Senator Pinckney in South Carolina. They seem to be almost hollow, although sometimes beautiful remarks on our behalf, but it's not coupled with the exercise of power from his office so as to work towards an elimination of the problem that we see. And that's what I'm talking about. So, no, I just didn't have time to write a treatise. Actually, a lot of this was inspired after the heinous racist slaughter by Dylann Roof at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston. And then, out the blue, President Obama spoke about black people and how we are, in sometimes vague terms and a couple of times more specific terms, how we're oftentimes the victims of a racist bigotry that we all know exists, and there's no need pretending it doesn't exist. He even said that. But he's presented it didn't exist for 6.5 years. With the exception of his great speech, you know, when they were criticizing him as he was running for president. So he gave the speech about being black and all of us need to receive the benefits of American society. And all of us will one day. And he did that when the Republicans were railing against him and Reverend Wright. And then, in contrast, He railed against Reverend Wright again when Reverend Wright persisted in condemning American bigotry. And earlier than that, while he was running for president, he was simply asked on Meet the Press about Minister Louis Farrakhan, even though there was no linkage evidence in any way between then-Senator Barack Obama and Minister Louis Farrakhan. And he was called upon to condemn Farrakhan, and he condemned him. And as far as I know, the two men never met. They have no contact with each other. In other words, he could serve the interests of Zionism, which actually call for that condemnation, and he could serve the interests of the American media, the news media, which wants to make clear that the black people running for office and many others running for office were holding contempt those who bitterly oppose Zionism as exhibited by the State of Israel, or who stand for black nationalism in the way that Minister Farrakhan has stood for. So he answered that call with no problem whatever. I remember, however, that when Troy Anthony Davis was about to be executed in Georgia, and Ben Jealous was mightily representing the NAACP and lobbying the five members of the Georgia Board of Pardon and Parole to save Troy's life, to commute his sentence or to pardon him. Ben Jealous got the agreement of the two black members, the chair and the vice chair, that they would vote to save Troy's life. But they said to him, you'll have to get one of the other three members, one of the white members. And all of them were, all five were very conservative. You'll have to get one of them. We'll vote to save his life. Don't worry about that, Mr. Jealous. That's what they said. That's what Mr. Jealous reported to us, to the public, and to all of us at Troy's wake. Okay, and so he went there, and what he did was he contacted a conservative former governor in the Deep South, had retired from office, and talked to that former governor who was for the death penalty, and talked to that governor and persuaded that governor to call one of the members of the board, the Georgia Board of Pardon and Parole. And that former governor persuaded a white member of the board to vote to save Troy's life. And at that point, when the vote was first taken, there were three votes to save his life, two to kill him. And when that happened, the black chair of the board changed his vote. I'm telling you what Ben Jealous said to the public. Now, this is my point. I literally called the Justice Department as one of Troy Davis's lawyers, lobbying them to intervene. Had President Obama been linked up with Ben Jealous, lobbying those five members of the Board of Pardon and Parole, I think Troy Davis would be alive today. They wouldn't do it. Eric Holder wasn't available. Barack Obama, President Obama didn't have the concern or the courage to intervene. And Troy Davis, wrongly convicted of murdering a white police officer in Savannah, Georgia, and wrongly convicted on the basis of witnesses, nine witnesses who said they saw him kill this man or heard him confess to it, but then later was largely exonerated when seven of the nine witnesses came forward and said, we lied under testimony at trial against that man. And some of them said that white police officers forced them to lie against Troy. Some said they actually saw the murder, and it was one of the two who didn't recant. The informant, described him as the actual murderer. And other witnesses verified it, both at trial and afterwards. But Troy Davis is dead. And Barack Obama, our president, never stepped into the fray to save a man's life. But he can step out when Trayvon Martin is dead. He can step out when nine people in Emmanuel AME Church are dead. Where is he while we are alive? The question that you asked me, I put back to the black community as a whole and to President Obama directly. When are we as black people going to organize ourselves to be clear about the agenda for political, economic, and social uplift and protection for ourselves and bring it properly, mightily, and clearly to the government, both federal and state, and even not just state, but municipal? And then when we do it, be clear about who represent us and hold those government agencies to the fire like Israel does. When are we going to do that? And then when is President Obama, as a black president, going to really be black? See, when I look at his work, and as I stated in my 2,500 page article,
word, there's no difference. 2,500 word.
25. I did say 2,500. 2,500 word article. Thank you, Utrees. You sound like you're my good friend right now. In that 2,500 word article, he has not distinguished himself from any of his white predecessors who've occupied the White House. Or even from George Washington, who never lived in the White House. I mean, it is remarkable. In effect, he behaves as though there is no moral or political obligation that he owes to black folk. But let me get clear. If you look at the history of Senator Lieberman, former Senator Lieberman out of Connecticut.
Joe Lieberman,
very astute, former prosecutor, state prosecutor in Connecticut, was elected to the U.S. Senate after, I believe, serving in the U.S. House of Representatives. I didn't follow him in the House of Representatives, but I followed him closely in the Senate. I followed him way before he was selected by Vice President Gore to be his running mate when Gore ran for president. I knew about him, and many regarded Senator Lieberman as like a closet Republican. But Senator Lieberman, as a Jewish man and as a Zionist, worked vigorously at every step in every way for the state of Israel, whether requested to do so or whether just doing it on his own. He was reliably a supporter of Israel and Zionism, whether it was harshly mistreating the people of Palestine or whether it was defending itself against its enemies, whether it was seeking benefits from the federal government of the United States in the form of subsidies and support and new inventions, or whether it just wanted an entree into the community of other nations throughout the world that oftentimes hold Israel in contempt. He was a vigorous advocate for Israel, and seemed to me to be more of an advocate for Israel than he was for the state of Connecticut. I just would like for one of the people we elect to office as black people to be like that for us. But at the least, when they serve everybody and serve everybody well, make sure they serve black people well. And I didn't see that from President Obama.
You indict the president, for lack of a, I'm putting it in legal terms since you're a lawyer. Your article, which appears, I want to remind the audience, in the June 29th edition of Counterpunch, you remind the audience and readers that this was not just confined to Obama's domestic policies. You indict him also on the same count for his, what you call, hypocritical actions on the international front as well. Could you talk about that?
Yes, I could. But, you know, just for the benefit of your audience, which I assume to be a wonderful audience, I'll just answer that by reading some of the article, just something. Interrupt me when you think I've hit the point.
Well, it has to be short. We're almost running out of time.
Most definitely. It's it. President Obama worked since his election in 2008 for several noteworthy causes. The reinforcement and greater enrichment of the billionaires and their multinational financial institutions on Wall Street. Number two, the furtherance of George Bush's effort to conquer, directly or indirectly, the vast petroleum reserves, the vast natural gas reserves, and the major water routes in North Africa and Southwest Asia. The protection and empowerment of the racially bigoted state of Israel. Number four, the political enslavement and hence the cultural and economic genocide of the Palestinian people. Number five, the enrichment of U.S. health insurers and U.S. pharmaceutical companies, largely through the Affordable Care Act. And then number six, the modernization of the racially bigoted status quo in U.S. police state and its imperialist military regime. Then I go on to say that under President Obama, the United States, along with the United Kingdom, targeted Zimbabwe for regime change, and that they did so by joining in with the United Kingdom on a program of regime change that was initiated by Tony Blair back in the 1980s, in the 1990s, he decided that the United Kingdom, which in the settlement of the Zimbabwean Revolution, Civil War, which was fought against Britain and against the Rhodesian white minority, that Britain would pay the cost of black people, the overwhelming majority of black people in Zimbabwe, buying back the land that the white minority had taken from them during Rhodesia's form of apartheid. And then under Tony Blair, they reneged on that, just wiped it out, and as a result, began a campaign not only to refuse to provide that money, but knowing that that refusal to subsidize that would lead to unrest on the part of the black majority in Zimbabwe, and would do so in a fashion that he hoped would lead to the ouster of President Robert Mugabe. And then a decade and a half later, Barack Obama joins in on that campaign, following in the footsteps of George Bush. And then we see further in my article that President Obama stood for other injustices against formerly colonized people. And I write, Under President Obama, the United States complete George Bush's conquest of Iraq and Afghanistan, as I said earlier, and also had military incursions into Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, and Syria. Under President Obama, the United States organized an insidiously bigoted embargo against Iran so as to crush Iran's research and investments into nuclear energy. Then I mentioned that that happened while the United States, under Obama's leadership, protected Israel's nuclear armament. So here we have the hypocrisy and the directed effort against the Iranian revolution. Now, whether people like it or not, the Iranian people have a right to have an Iranian nationalist state, a communist state, or a capitalist society. They're not bound to follow the dictates of an American president or the U.S. Congress with regard to how they will set up their society and their government. And I followed that critique by saying that under President Obama, the United States imposed extraordinary political and economic pressure against the Venezuelan people's experiment with economic egalitarianism, against the Cuban people's experiment with a morally conscious socialism, against the Iranian people's experiment with revolutionary Shia nationalism, and with the Colombian people's rebellion against tyranny. Now, how in the world is it that Obama is siding with the wrong side in Zimbabwe, against Venezuela, against Iran, against Cuba, and against Colombia, and all of those nations? Iran is an Asiatic white nation by and large. But with the exception of Iran, all of those nations are people with a huge populace of black folk. And even with Iran, those are people, Asiatic or whatever, who deserve to be respected in their human rights and their human dignity. How is it that President Obama, who promises transparency and the uplift of the world society, sides with evil oppression that's been the hallmark of American imperialism once he becomes president, if he's going to be new and different, if he's going to be for good and right, if he's going to be against injustice and for justice? And when I speak of justice, very quickly, Eutrice, I want to borrow from the definition of a philosopher here in the D.C. Baltimore area. This philosopher named Neely Fuller, extraordinary mind, and great influence on psychiatrist Francis Cress Wilson. Mr. Fuller defines justice in this way. First of all, in the fashion that nobody, absolutely nobody, can be mistreated. That's first of all. And then second of all, that those who need the most help get the most help. I love that definition of justice. And when I apply that to President Obama and his administration, I don't see that with regard to black people, the Cuban people, and even with the recent change where he's opening up diplomatic relations with Cuba. I don't see it with the Obama administration with regard to Venezuela, with regard to Colombia, even though he mightily supports the Colombian government, which is very oppressive of the poor and the black people in Colombia. I don't see it with regard to Iran. I am just troubled that Israel can have nuclear weapons and have it in a fashion that threatens Arabs in Southwest Asia and African Arab peoples in North Africa, but Iran can't have nuclear power with the potential for nuclear weapons such that it can expand its base for emerging into the 21st century with modern technology and, if necessary, be able to defend itself against the genocidal threat of Israel and the United States. But assuming that they have no nuclear weapons, which there's never been any evidence of, I wonder why they can't develop nuclear power without being overly restricted in the fashion that the U.S. is threatening.
I want to thank you so much, Thomas Ruffin, for discussing this article. I recommend that everybody read it, June 29th edition of Counterpunch. And it is a wide-ranging but very, very insightful article. Titled, The President Did Little for Black People When They Needed Him the Most, Why Obama is a Race Traitor. We've been discussing the disposition of the American people, that wonderful phrase, in this time when so much is leading us back to the central question here, which is about white supremacy in the United States. In your article, you essentially brought the question of white supremacy into the White House. Thank you so much for being with us today, and we will be talking again soon, I hope.
Thank you so much. You're wonderful.
But you laid out your point very well. I'm hoping that we can hear from the public listeners, and they'll let us know how your argument stood up under their scrutiny today. But thank you, and we will talk again soon.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you.